Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
Quiet on set.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action.
That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today.
The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
According to a poll published by the Pew Research Center in September 2023, Americans' trust in Congress as an institution continues to hover at an all-time low. 72% of respondents expressed an unfavorable view of the legislative branch. Given the recent turmoil in the House, I can't say I'm particularly gobsmacked. Hello, welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Anne Hartley, your unsurprised host. We recently released a film with the Article 1 Initiative that talks about Congress and its dysfunctional budget process. Joining me today is Philip Wallach, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, who knows a thing or two about the inner workings of Congress. Welcome, Philip.
Great to be with you.
Glad to have you here today. So why do you think we continue to see this trend of declining trust in Congress?
Well, I think an awful lot of what our legislators spend their time doing is trying to make their counterparts on the other side of the aisle look bad, and they're pretty good at it. So just that basic orientation of our politics is bound to make Congress seem like a bad place in many ways. But I think even deeper than that, Congress just is an institution that is troubled, that has a difficult time fulfilling its core responsibilities. It's sort of become a constant struggle for Congress to even keep the lights on. And just pass annual spending bills that it really has to pass. And to do anything more ambitious where people have a sense that Congress is taking stock of big problems facing the American people and taking construction action on those problems, people really feel like that's really the exception rather than the rule if it happens at all. And I think people have become pretty cynical about what they can expect out of Congress. And unfortunately, that cynicism has a lot of justification.
Absolutely. I can't say I disagree. So how big of a role do you think that the recent shutdowns and near shutdowns in the past few years have had in public perception of Congress?
I think it's not the only thing going on, but it's a sort of unusually salient demonstration of Congress's problems that makes its way onto the front pages of the papers and the evening news shows and all the rest, such that people can't just ignore congressional dysfunction. It sort of hits them right in the face. And they hear all these stories once every year or two about how Congress may not even decide to maintain America's payments on its debts, which might cause a catastrophic default and a financial crisis. So people are always sort of waiting for Congress to mess things up these days. I think the shutdowns really contribute to that sense, but they're not the only thing that causes it.
Gotcha. What do you think are the other causes?
Well, I think people do have a sense that there are some pressing problems, right? Immigration, control of the southern border, there's a pretty widespread consensus that these things really need action and that Congress really ought to do something. And yet at the same time, people have sort of lost their faith in Congress as the kind of place that would do anything. It's instead the kind of place that points its fingers at the executive branch and looks for scandals related to immigration policy and management of the southern border, but doesn't actually lift a finger to actually find a solution. And I think there's a sense that finding a solution that both parties could support is just impossible. But yeah, that sort of goes along with this sense of futility about the whole institution.
So do you think this is an institutional problem, or is this a problem with individual legislators?
It's definitely institutional. Some people want to believe, oh, well, we just have a bunch of corrupt idiots in Congress, and that's our basic problem. If only we could get better people, we would be in better shape. That's not right. There may be some corrupt people and there may be some idiots, but that's not really most of them. Most legislators are ambitious people who want to do good things, but they're stuck in an institutional reality that doesn't reward constructive behavior. It rewards destructive behavior. And it's hard to find our way out of sort of the bad equilibrium that we find ourselves in. You know, it's easy for some of us to sort of say from the sidelines, oh, well, if you all acted differently, things would be better. But people really are acting rationally within the bounds of the system that they find themselves in. And when each of these parties thinks about how it can tee up the next election in the most favorable way to itself, because it thinks, hey, maybe we can grab control of the Congress at the next election, that's been pretty rational in the 21st century. This is an unusual era of American political history where the two parties are very closely matched, and they're always scheming to grab the majority from each other, and they're often successful. So it's a rational mindset that a lot of them are in, and it's very election-focused rather than governing-focused.
Oh, gotcha. So I like that comparison where it's we're looking towards elections rather than towards governance.
Yeah, and I think the members who people hear the most about, unfortunately, are the members who have leaned hardest into this dynamic, right? Who have sort of officially given up on governing and sort of make a full-time job of raising their own profiles as critics of the system. And, you know, there's a lot of justified complaints about the system. So some of what they say can be right on target, but at the same time, they're really not helping, lift us out of this bad equilibrium. They're really sort of centrally contributing to it.
So I'm curious how far back this dysfunction goes.
Yeah, it's not the easiest question to answer. A long development of the current pattern in Congress. And one thing we haven't talked about is one of the characteristic features of our Congress today is that it is leader dominated, really to an unusual extent in the history of both the House and the Senate. Both chambers are leader dominated today. That's not a trend that arrived all at once. It built from the mid-1980s onward, really. We were in a kind of decentralized time prior to that in the 1970s and early 80s, and there was problems with the decentralized pattern, and members sort of moved toward putting more power and trust in their party leaders from the mid-80s onward. So that was true when Republicans were in the minority, you know, for the longest time. At the tail end of that period, they got very fed up with the way that the Democratic majority was exercising its power. But then when Republicans took over in the 90s, Newt Gingrich talked a lot about making Congress a more business-like institution. And Republicans delivered on that in certain ways, but they absolutely did not move away from this top-down model. They reinforced that pattern. Gingrich wanted to run everything out of the Speaker's office. He almost seemed to think of himself as like akin to a prime minister at times. And I think Nancy Pelosi, obviously not a fan of a lot of things about the Republican Party, but took on that model herself in her two stints as Speaker. She was a feared Speaker. And so a lot of the problems that we have with the dysfunction of the institution are closely tied up in this dominance of our congressional leaders. You know, it ought to be said that Congress is not literally capable of doing nothing. That's not a fair characterization. Congress does push things through. It has its leaders make deals that they then push through the Congress in various kinds of circumstances, including in response to crises. Congress has been very active in the 21st century. But all that time, you know, the way in which it's active is nevertheless contributing to a sense that the regular membership is cut out of the picture. It's not a very deliberative body. Neither chamber really is very deliberative, especially the House. So it's a long trend at this point. You know, people feel like it's gone on forever, and I can understand why. In terms of political cycles, we've been in it for a while, but it's not the way Congress has always been.
Well, that is certainly good to hear. So I'm curious, since we made this film about the omnibus, does that fit into what you've been describing with this accretion of power towards congressional leadership?
Absolutely. So packaging things into omnibuses is one of the main tools leaders have to sort of force their members' hands, right? If you pretty much say, well, here's all the governing work we're going to do, here's in one big package, you have to vote yes or no. Well, your own party's members are going to feel a tremendous amount of pressure to say yes, because so much of your party's priorities are included in this bill. The other party is put in the position of saying, are we going to work really hard to try to block this thing, in which case we may just be shutting down the government, or we may be failing to pass all these laws that basically we regard as must-pass laws. So it's meant to jam up members. That's the phrase a lot of them like to use. It's meant to jam them up and give them no real choice. And it's very effective. And so that goes back to this mid-1980s. This was a huge complaint that Republicans made during the 1980s. One of the things they said was, it takes away the president's ability to even use his veto in a judicious manner, because it basically says, dares the president to shut down the government, or if he doesn't want to do that, then he has to accept the bill in its entirety, even if it's stuffed with inappropriate or corrupt provisions. And so, yeah, that was a major bone of contention in the 1980s. But again, strikingly, that wasn't a critique that Republicans really managed to carry over very consistently into their own majority. Once Gingrich got the majority, suddenly he and his majority leader, Dick Armey, had a strategy for using omnibuses to force President Clinton to do what they wanted him to do, which was a major part of their strategy in the 104th Congress. So both parties have relied very heavily on packaging things into omnibuses as a way of forcing things through and allowing the leaders to really control what gets a vote at the end of the day. Because a lot of times, if you're not catching a ride on the bus, you're sort of not going anywhere in a lot of cases. So, and the ones who decide who gets on the bus are the leaders.
Gotcha. So do you think that the leaders like the omnibus process, or is it just that it's useful to them?
Yeah, I'd say, I'm not sure if you just put the question to them that starkly that they would say, oh yeah, of course we like it, because of course it's a really stressful way of managing things. But it is in some ways the norm at this point, and it's very tightly connected to leader dominance. And leaders do believe that their own dominance is very important. They basically think that the institution will fall to pieces if we don't have leader dominance, that everything will just be a big chaotic mess. And they need to tightly manage what exactly gets a vote, because if the membership starts to get deciding what gets voted on, they will sort of take us in a million different directions at once, and nothing will be able to get across the line in the end. I think that's a very much overstated position. I think it's an exaggeration, and I think things would be fine if leaders were less dominant, but they're not totally without basis. I think when we have seen in recent years, we have a very tightly bottled up process. So when you do open the door a crack and let members start to participate in a more flexible manner, you do see that it's sort of opening the floodgates. All these different concerns members have come out, often expressed in different amendments. So you get hundreds and hundreds of amendments to a bill when there's an opportunity to do it. And it does seem rather unmanageable. And so the omnibus is manageable. The omnibus is a manageable way of doing things. And that's sort of the leader's ultimate refrain that they've sold the membership on for many years now. Well, we're going to manage things. We're going to keep things together. And of course, it would be strange of us not to refer to the drama unfolding in the House here in the fall of 2023. Part of how we have to understand this drama is that some part of the membership is just saying enough. We're no longer willing to play this game. Manageability doesn't sound good enough to us to justify our diminishment as representatives in the House. And so we've had a revolt, and we have a new speaker as of yesterday. as we're recording this, and we'll have to see whether that new boss in the House means a different pattern of interactions between the leadership and the membership.
So do you think that we're going to see future revolts or any significant changes here?
Well, it's funny. Representative Mike Johnson, in accepting this speakership yesterday, laid a very great stress on his desire to have a more decentralized House, one where the membership has a greater say in how things operate. And so that does seem like it may take things in a new direction, but it has to be said that previous speakers have made very, very similar promises, including Kevin McCarthy at the beginning of this Congress. But certainly Paul Ryan, when he became speaker, sort of had a similar refrain. And it's hard to keep these promises because people are very used to the existing patterns. But if we do revert to the existing pattern, it does seem like the same conflicts ought to just recur, because taking Kevin McCarthy out of the speaker's chair and putting Mike Johnson in doesn't really change anything about the fundamental dynamics, which is we do have must-pass legislation that has to get through the House, and there is a part of the Republican Party that basically thinks any legislation that can get through and also get the support of the Democrat-controlled Senate and the President Joe Biden is not something that they should be a part of. And that pretty much necessitates passing bipartisan deals through the House of Representatives. And Mike Johnson really doesn't seem like there should be any magical answer that he can provide to get us out of that fundamental dynamic. So the tensions that brought down McCarthy are still there beneath the surface. There may be a kind of honeymoon period, a ceasefire, where we just sort of let things go without bringing them to a head. But I don't really see why another revolt isn't in the cards before long. If Johnson does manage to open the House up some, as his predecessors really weren't able to do, I think it's still not clear that he'll be able to avoid some kind of revolt, though, because it does seem like part of the problem is that some members of the Republican Party really expect certain policy objectives that are important to them to just get realized on the basis of their own strong desire to see them realized, and especially big cuts to spending. And it's not really clear how they think a more open process will get us to that point, because probably there are pretty strong bipartisan majorities defending the spending of the status quo. And so I'm sympathetic to the idea that we really need to cut back our spending in a serious way. But in terms of how the process is going to get us there, it's not a very easy story to tell.
Gotcha. So it's a difficult path to fixing the budget process and to fixing Congress.
That if there's one thing we can be sure we've said right today, that is it. You know, it's this frustrating thing because at some level we all know that things have to change, and there can be wide agreement that the current process is broken, but actually taking steps to change the process and force our representatives to take more responsibility in this moment, instead of just kicking the can to the future, is really, really difficult, because you can understand why our elected officials would just prefer to make it somebody else's problem in the future.
No doubt about it. Well, thank you for joining us today, Philip. Where can our listeners learn more about Congress?
Well, I'd be remiss if I did not recommend my recently published book, Why Congress, which was published by Oxford University Press this year, and talks about a lot of these dynamics at length. I think I'm also a reluctant but somewhat steady Xer, or whatever you're supposed to call it these days, and at Philip Wallach, commenting on the developments in the House frequently there.
All righty, we'll have to keep an eye out. Thanks again, Philip, and thank you folks for listening in. You can find our film Omnibus in the description on our YouTube channel or at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.